Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, September 22nd, welcome, welcome, welcome to the show on this fall day. I'm Cherry Gregg.
First day of fall indeed. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
So today we're asking a question that cuts to the bone of American media. Can a late night joke cost you your FCC broadcast license? If you haven't heard, last week, following comedian and late night host Jimmy Kimmel's monologue on the killing of Charlie Kirk, FCC Chair Brendan Carr told broadcasters, "We can do this the easy way or the hard way." Hours later, Disney and ABC suspended Kimmel, and as of today, his show remains off air. The timing of ABC's decision has raised a host of questions about whether the FCC pressure was simply legal oversight and regulation in the public interest, or whether it was government censorship forbidden by the First Amendment. So today on the show, we have two guests, NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik, as well as constitutional scholar Eugene Volokh, who will help us peel back the layers of how we got here, what the law says about what the FCC and the government powers are when it comes to broadcasters, and a whole lot more. And we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere. Our question of the day is this: what do you think about Disney suspending Jimmy Kimmel and the FCC's pressure? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, please share this video, but also leave your comments in the live chat.
I'll repeat the number one more time, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. First, a trio of local news stories starting over the bridge in New Jersey. Yesterday, New Jersey gubernatorial candidates Jack Cittarelli and Mikey Sherrill met for the first of two debates. Nice recap, by the way, by our own David Matthau at WHYY.org. The two tangled over affordability, education, Donald Trump, Phil Murphy, et cetera, et cetera. But one tit for tat that really seemed to generate a lot of attention, at least on the internet, was about the killing of activist Charlie Kirk. As a congresswoman, Sherrill supported a resolution in the U.S. House to condemn Kirk's murder. She also put out a statement condemning some of Kirk's views. Cittarelli took her to task for not saying whether she'd support a local bill that would classify political violence as a hate crime. Let's hear some of that exchange.
She still hasn't answered your question, and we see this time and time in the campaign. Generalities, platitudes, ducking the direct question by not giving a direct answer.
That's just not true. My direct answer is, I voted to protect free speech. I voted to end political violence. I also think it's fair, Jack, to speak up when you disagree with something. And so if you want to stand up that Martin Luther King was a bad guy, or that women should submit to their husbands, you, Jack, are welcome to do that. And I have the right to say that I disagree with it.
Oh, there you go. So a bit of fire in that exchange. I know it caught your attention, Cheryl.
Yeah, it definitely caught my attention over the weekend. And, you know, it got pretty testy there. And it's, you know, we see that it's fast becoming a local issue. There is that bipartisan effort in New Jersey to make political violence a hate crime. And so there is now this political pressure to put teeth into that bill. And people on both sides of the aisle in New Jersey are being tested. But, you know, it just goes to show how this national issue has been localized. And now it could fast become a critical topic of discussion in the local New Jersey gubernatorial race.
Purely from the perspective of political strategy, I don't think this is a road that Cittarelli wants to walk down, frankly.
Yeah.
I think he should want to localize this race, make it about prices, make it about Phil Murphy specifically. Do not make it about national politics, where generally Republicans are at a disadvantage in New Jersey. And the polling suggests that the more you make this about national politics, the worse it looks for the Republican. I understand what he was trying to do there, trying to connect this to this broader idea that Sherrill is wishy-washy, that she doesn't take hard stands on things, that she offers platitudes. I get that. And I think some of that criticism is fair. But I think generally this is the type of thing he would want to avoid. And if this is indeed the standout moment from the debate, I just can't see that being a great thing for Cittarelli, frankly.
Yeah, yeah, and it's going to be an interesting race. All eyes on New Jersey for this. Story number two, legendary Flyer goalie Bernie Parent has died. He was 80 years old, and I haven't been a huge hockey fan, but even I, having lived in Philadelphia, know who Bernie Parent is. The Hall of Famer is most known as the guy who brought the Philadelphia Flyers, a.k.a. Broad Street Bullies, not one, but two consecutive Stanley Cups. Parent clinched the wins with shutouts, first in 1974 with a 1-0 final game win against the Boston Bruins, and then again in 1975 with a 2-0 win against the Buffalo Sabres. And Parent played 10 of his 13 seasons in the National Hockey League with the Flyers. And even though he grew up in Montreal, he is very much beloved by Philadelphians, and tributes poured in from far and wide. And by the way, we want to play this clip. It's from 2017 when he was live on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, talking about when he got drafted to the Flyers and came to the city of Philadelphia. Take a listen.
I said, where's Philly at?
Really?
Yeah. And then they put us on the float. 24 Flyers got drafted.
Yeah.
And we went through Broad Street introduce us to the
city. Right down the center of Philadelphia.
And we had more people on the float than we had watching us. But, you know, it's a good story because 7 years later, we won the Stanley Cup and we had 2 million people.
Yeah,
and by the way, the NHL expanded in 1967, and at the time he had been in Boston, and so came to Philly, and people just love him. And by the way, Bobby Clark, captain of one of the Stanley Cup teams, he says Bernie never had a bad day. He also says that the Flyers don't win two Stanley Cups unless we have Bernie. Bernie was the one person that we could not win without. So rest in peace.
Yeah, universally beloved. You just don't hear a bad word about Bernie Parent. And, you know, that period of time, really 1973 to 1983, I believe, and many others believe, is like the golden age of Philadelphia sports. All mm-hmm. four teams made it to the championship round over those 10 years. Three of them won championships in those 10 years. The Flyers led all of that off with their back-to-backs in 74 and 75. And, you know, Bernie is on the Mount Rushmore, I think, period of time in Philly sports with Dr. J and Bobby Clark and others. And it's sort of juxtaposed with that being a really tough 10 years for the city of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Population loss, really high crime. And that was a moment where sports was a healer for a lot of people.
Yeah, brought people together.
And Bernie Parent was a huge part of that. And I hope that, and I believe that is part of his great legacy. So like you said, rest in peace, Bernie Parent. One more story.
Sports.
On sports. The best thing I saw this weekend, Cherry. The best thing I saw this weekend. So the Eagles-Rams game on Sunday had an unbelievable ending. The Rams were about to kick a game-winning field goal as time expired, but big man Jordan Davis rose up, blocked the kick, scooped the ball up, and ran 60 yards down the field for a touchdown.
Wow, wow, wow.
Here is how it sounded on Fox.
Joshua Cardi.
So the fans, of course, are losing their minds.
Jumping
the
around.
Players are losing their minds. The coach is losing his mind. And then there's quarterback Jalen Hurts. When I tell you Jalen Hurts had no reaction to this, I am not exaggerating. This is one of the craziest plays you will ever see. He's on the sidelines. He does not emote at all. There are cloistered monks that would have had a stronger reaction to this play than Jalen Hurts. It's unbelievable. I cannot stop watching the video of him not reacting to this play.
Yeah.
What's your reaction to his non-reaction?
Well, his reaction, he bit his lip. It looked like his lip was about to start bleeding.
Oh, you
he bit it so
like
hard.
You like Zapruder'd this thing. You got in close. You
I
said
was
he bit
like,
his lip.
He was like, I mean, he looked like he was trying to hold it in. And by the way, you know, I'm a huge Jalen Hurts fan.
How could you not?
And I believe he has been here before in another life. I'm getting real woo-woo on y'all. He is so cool. He's so calm and collected. Definitely an old soul. But he was biting his lip. I feel like that's a reaction, don't you?
Yeah, and I think some people think he's very level-headed,
yes,
to put it mildly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people think it's an act. It's not an act.
No.
If you can do that in that situation, then you truly do have an internal level of calm that mm-hmm. most people cannot access.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think was his internal monologue, like, while this was all happening?
Never get too low, never get too high. I'm biting my lip. If you can see me, I'm biting my lip.
You think that's what's going through his head?
That's what's going through his head.
Never get too low, never get too high.
Just that's the mantra going through his brain at that moment. What do you think?
I think it was something like, that football play went well. That's what I think. I think it's just he's able to get to a place of blankness.
Yeah.
In the the craziest moments, and I admire it deeply.
But I feel like he's saving he goes to the locker room, he's like, yes.
No, he is.
Yeah.
He can get to the other place too.
Yeah.
But to be in the moment and react that way is like, he should teach classes on that.
I would go. I need that.
I needed so much of it. Maybe for the next conversation we're about to have about Disney and ABC suspending Jimmy Kimmel and the FCC pressure on broadcasters. Stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. A series of events last week kickstarted a national conversation on free speech, a conversation unlike any in recent memory. It started on Monday. ABC late night host Jimmy Kimmel said the following about the killing of Charlie Kirk.
We hit some new lows over the weekend with the MAGA gang desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them and doing everything they can to score political points from it.
2 days later, FCC Chairman Brendan Carr did an interview with a conservative commentator in which he said the following.
I mean, look, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. These companies can find ways to change conduct, to take action, frankly, on Kimmel, or, you know, there's going to be additional work for the FCC ahead.
Before Wednesday was over, two major ABC carriers said they were preempting Kimmel's show, and shortly after that, ABC suspended the late-night host indefinitely.
Many conservatives celebrated the decision, including President Donald Trump, who intimated that more pressure could be coming.
If they're 97% against, they give me only bad publicity or press. I mean, they're getting a license. I would think maybe their license should be taken away. It will be up to Brendan Carr.
But backlash to ABC's decision was also vociferous, even among some on the right. Texas Senator Ted Cruz, an arch conservative, had this to say.
What he said there is dangerous as hell. He says, we can do this the easy way, or we can do this the hard way. And I got to say, that's right out of Goodfellas. That's right out of a mafioso coming into a bar going, nice bar you have here. It'd be a shame if something happened to it.
And the he's referring to there is Brendan Carr, by the way. So what now? Will the FCC pursue penalties against major broadcasters? Will broadcasters acquiesce? And what does all of this say about the power of federal regulators like the FCC? Should that power be curtailed?
We have two guests with us this hour, and many of you know David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
And we also have Eugene Volokh, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and a First Amendment law expert. Eugene, nice to have you.
Pleasure being on.
Pleasure to have you. Before we begin, this disclosure. WHYY is regulated by the FCC and received an inquiry earlier this year from the commission unrelated to its programming or journalism. Now to our question of the day for the audience. What do you think about Disney/ABC suspending Jimmy Kimmel and the FCC's pressure? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, David, we want to start with you and talk about the facts a little bit, because we laid out the timeline for this decision to suspend Kimmel. But now we want to pull back the curtain on the Disney ABC decision to institute that suspension. What do we know about what went into it?
Well, I think that, the bare bones that you set the table with were helpful and they get you along the way. You know, Brendan Carr, of course, is the chief regulator of broadcasting in the country, and that includes the ABC network. But really, the regulations are of the local stations. They hold individual licenses that are given to them, granted to them by the FCC to have what are called the public's airwaves, right? These frequencies that you're doing, I think it's 90.9 FM in the Philly area, right? Mm-hmm. So that, you know, they're making sure that only you guys get through on that frequency, and you have to, you know, serve the public's interest in order to hold on to it. This is also a pressure point for those who are wanting to or willing to use pressure once they're in government. You had these two major station groups, Nexstar, based in Dallas or outside Dallas, and Sinclair Broadcast, based outside Baltimore, both of whom in differing ways are considered a little bit more conservative of station groups, but nonetheless, among the most important clients ABC has, because they have, each of them, dozens of ABC stations around the country that carry ABC shows. And they announced after Carr's pressure that you played on Benny Johnson's podcast, they announced that they would be indefinitely suspending Kimmel, and Disney followed. It is worth pointing out that there is an entanglement. There is an array or a network, if you will, of involvements and relationships here. Nexstar has proposed buying Tegna and wants to reach about, in total, Nexstar is the largest owner of television stations in the country, local TV stations in the country. It has about, there's a cap currently at 39% of the country. You can't reach more than 39% of Americans at once in commercial television. They thought that would be too much of one company having too much of a voice around the country. In order to do this, you know, they are pushing for the level to be raised to 80%, which would be a real radical change in how the regulations work. There are arguments for that. We're in an age of streaming. We're in the age of the internet. You know, a lot of secular TV watching is down, although local TV has done pretty well. But there are arguments for it. But what they're arguing is something that the FCC itself has to determine. Carr says something about what he wants to have happen, and a couple hours later, Nexstar does the same. Sinclair is in the process of selling a few of its stations and is considering selling off far more in order to offload a significant amount of debt. Who gets to determine whether those licenses could be transferred to a new owner? It's the Federal Communications Commission, Brendan Carr. And Disney, of course, has its own deals that will be looked at by antitrust regulators, some of them by Carr, a big one involving ESPN, the NFL, by other antitrust regulators. These are all points at which decisions seemingly made by private corporate actors are being greatly influenced by what federal regulators are saying publicly and privately.
Yeah. Eugene, want to bring you in the conversation now, because the backstop for all of this is that the FCC does have the ability, on some level, to regulate content and what goes out on airwaves. I mean, they do. There's certain words you can't say. I can't say right now because the FCC could penalize my employer. How did we get to a place legally where the FCC has some power over what can be said on public airwaves, a power that seems like the government doesn't have in other areas to regulate speech? I mean, how do we end up in this place, Eugene?
Sure. So it started about 100 years ago with the invention at that point of radio. And there was a concern, as David pointed out, that you need to be able to have frequency all your own in order for people to be able to hear you. So there needed to be regulation just at the level of allocating frequencies to particular people. And you could have imagined saying, okay, fine, we're going to allocate this frequency, and then you can say whatever you want.
Get out of the way after that. Yeah.
Exactly. But the rationale was, if we're going to give you this huge benefit that nobody else enjoys, it has to come with some conditions. One way of thinking about it is there are two kinds of restrictions that we see out there on broadcasting. One is the one that applies to 99.99% of everybody. And that is, you can't broadcast. It's illegal for you to broadcast because you don't have a license. And you won't be given a license because you can't just get it like a driver's license just by passing some test, right? And then there are the restrictions imposed in the 0.01%. That they should broadcast in the public interest, that they not include vulgarity, the old fairness doctrine where they had to provide supposed balance on various issues, the personal attack rule where they had to give people a chance to respond to personal attacks. So as a result, The argument was that you need to be able to impose these mandates on the privileged few that get this special government provided.
And the Supreme Court said that's okay, even though we have this thing called the First Amendment.
The Supreme Court said that's okay unanimously in 1969 as to the Fairness Doctrine. By the way, 5 years later, they unanimously struck down actually a narrower version of the Fairness Doctrine for newspapers, where there was a right of reply provided by the state. The court unanimously in 1974 says, of course, that's unconstitutional interference with the newspaper owner's discretion. 5 years after having unanimously upheld this as to broadcasting, very different. Likewise, in the late 1970s, it upheld the ban on vulgarities on broadcasting. Now, the Fairness Doctrine was repealed by the Federal Communications Commission in the mid-1980s. On the grounds that actually, given changes in the marketplace, it actually no longer is consistent with the First Amendment. And one of the rationales was that these kinds of rules, even if they're ostensibly neutral, fairness, public interest, actually end up deterring controversial views and giving the government too much power. And I think this is one of the things we're seeing here, as we'd seen before. The Roosevelt administration did it back in the day. The Kennedy and Johnson administrations did it, as I understand it. The Nixon administration did it as well, this kind of power can be leveraged into suppressing views that the administration doesn't like. That's a very serious problem.
Yeah. And I want to sort of dig into that a little bit, but by looking at it through the lens of our FCC commissioner, Brendan Carr. And David, could you talk a little bit about Brendan Carr, who he is, and sort of how he became this person? Because just a few years ago, not even just a couple years ago, he seemed to speak very differently of FCC's power and censorship and seemed to be very much pro First Amendment.
I think that's exactly right. That's what the record shows. I mean, Brendan Carr, from everybody I've spoken to, Republican and Democrat, was described as smart, as capable, quite conservative, sort of a conventional, you know, we heard about the Ronald Reagan years earlier, conventional Reaganite approach to thinking about regulation, wanting to strip some of that away, some of the inhibitions on certain kinds of innovations or expansion by corporate actors, but nothing like this. And he really was seen that way really until a few years ago. He had, for example, during his own confirmation hearings, I believe in subsequent hearings a year later, 2018, Trump had nominated him, elevated him from a staffer to be a commissioner. 2018, in response to a Democratic senator from New Hampshire, Carr talked about the important and transcendent importance of freedom of speech, and that he thought that the FCC getting involved in regulating speech to any greater degree was a problem. He would try to be a protector, he said, on the commission of the freedom of speech of broadcasters, whatever it might be. And again, in I think it was around 2023, when there were questions about Joe Biden having perhaps pressured, and his administration as president having pressured social media platforms, he again talked about the importance of presidential administrations not putting pressure on that in any way constricted the flow of free speech, you know, within some of the boundaries that Gene talked about, and, you know, certain normal things like, you know, you can't purvey child pornography, you can't defame somebody in a way that can be adjudicated in court and things like that. But he really was seeming as though he was taking a principled conservative position in favor of free speech. And yet, last year, while on the commission, and after getting what he said was ethical dispensation from the FCC, he wrote a chapter in what's called Project 2025, put out by the Conservative Heritage Foundation, that essentially was a blueprint for what might come on certain kinds of regulatory things, but also in terms of the FCC, and became kind of a cable news avatar and champion for, if you like, MAGAism and its approach towards the media. Trump names him and says this guy will be a warrior for freedom of speech, but really it was a warrior for the kind of speech that Trump likes. And, you know, so he's been talking about Charlie Kirk in recent days and the question of, you know, there, criticism that redounded to Kirk both before and after his assassination, but at exercising pressure, as we saw on, we saw previously on CBS, which ahead of his approval of its sale to Skydance and to the Ellison family, you know, that company's previous owners got rid of Stephen Colbert, a thorn in his side. Yeah. There are financial reasons why this can be done. And let's acknowledge, and I've read Gene's postings for years, so I know he's, you know, first and foremost a scholar that believes this stuff. But, you know, as private actors, CBS and its owners, they have their own free speech. They can decide who they want to elevate, who they want to employ. ABC has the right to want to employ Kimmel or to change its mind within the strictures of his contract with them, or to pay him out if they don't want him anymore. It's very different. You know, I think Senator Cruz probably has to work on his Joe Pesci impression. But his point, his point resonates across parties for many folks, and in an earlier era would have been uncontroversial. And that is that to say this can be done the easy way or the hard way, two companies, major corporate players that have interest before the FCC leap to embrace his position, and then Disney finds itself in a quandary that is not one where it's exercising its free speech at all, but it's operating in a climate of coercion. That's a very different nature. Brendan Carr turned from the defender of the First Amendment to waging war on those who have speech that the president doesn't like.
And the timing in itself seems a bit curious. Even if you don't, even if you don't really know the motivations, the timing itself, to me, raises a lot of questions. And I wanted to ask you a quick follow-up, Eugene, here, because is this type of action, the type of statements that we've heard Commissioner Carr say, is that something you've seen that we've seen happen previously, or is this unprecedented?
Oh, yes, plenty of we've seen of this. And this is where we can bring in the National Rifle Association. Last year, the National Rifle Association won a particular decision. It's just a battle in the longer litigation in a case against the New York State Financial Regulatory Authorities. The case is called NRA v. Vulo. And the NRA alleged, and I think I was a lawyer for the NRA there, but I'm speaking here about the public record. I think there was at least plausible basis for the allegation that the New York regulatory authorities were pressuring, in that instance, financial intermediaries, things like banks and insurance companies, to cut off or to limit their relations with the NRA. And they were doing that because they disapproved of the NRA's viewpoints and wanted to make it harder for the NRA to spread its viewpoints. And the Supreme Court unanimously said that trying to leverage that kind of threat, essentially against intermediaries, in order to suppress the speech of political speakers, is generally speaking unconstitutional. That's an important principle, which I think applies fully here. Interestingly, the NRA was represented in oral argument by David Cole, the National Legal Director of the ACLU. Mm-hmm. ACLU disagrees with NRA on many things, but they realized, I think, that if a blue state or a blue administration can use this kind of indirect pressure to try to restrict the speech of the NRA, then red states and red administrations could use similar pressure on intermediaries as well. And I think they proved quite prescient.
Of course, all of this hinges on the aggrieved party filing a lawsuit and taking it all the way to the Supreme Court, something we really haven't seen yet in this particular arena we're talking about with what's happened over the last 6 months or so and the FCC. So I guess stay tuned on that. But let's get some callers in. Monica from Montgomery, New Jersey is on line two, has a comment to offer. Hey, Monica, you're on Studio 2. What is your comment?
My comment is that canceling Jimmy Kimmel is a threat to democracy. Jimmy didn't say anything inaccurate or untrue. And I'm originally from Venezuela, and I feel like I'm reliving history. When Chavez took on the government back in 1999, he shut down TV channels. And for over 20 years, there is no freedom of speech in that country. And I feel like it's starting to happen here, and it's extremely scary. I know I'm just one person, but I'm definitely canceling my Disney subscription.
Thank you so much, Monica. I'm curious what you make of that, Eugene, because I you know, this is sometimes voices on the right will say that there's an overreaction to anything that Trump or a Trump regulator does. Do you see this rising to the level of potentially unprecedented, at least in this particular space, the FCC? Do you see this rising to the level of like existential threat to the First Amendment? I mean, try to give us a sense of your scale of concern here.
Right. It's not unprecedented. As I said, past administrations have indeed tried to use the FCC in order to suppress speech, and sometimes in a considerably more massive way. I don't think it's an existential threat as such. At the same time, I agree with Senator Cruz on this. This is a very serious potential threat, especially if the federal government gets away with it and doesn't feel political pushback. You're right that legal pushback is hard. Among other things, Jimmy Kimmel, even if he maybe theoretically could sue over it as a business matter, probably a very good reason for him not to.
Yeah.
If it gets away with it without enough political pushback, then it'll try it again, and that would be bad. I should say that Kimmel's statements were, in fact, inaccurate.
Yeah.
Desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them, that quite clearly implies that he was in fact one of them, that he was in fact part of the quote MAGA crowd, close quote. That is apparently, as best we can tell, just not true. So he did say something that was inaccurate, but I don't think that can be a basis for the government to demand that his entire.
Can I just ask you as a follow up, Gene? Yeah. I'm curious though, like if, and maybe there are good examples of this, I'd just like to hear them. Like what strikes me as a little bit different about this particular case and some of what we've seen in the past from the FCC, it is you leveraging one FCC authority, which is the control over, you know, mergers and corporate power, to influence speech, right? So like making those,
right.
the bridging those two powers in a way that sort of makes them work in concert with each other. And I know you were saying that in New York State, right, they were trying to do that, something similar around the NRA. Yeah. But I'm curious if what you've seen in the past, you mentioned the Johnson administration, Kennedy, FDR, even Nixon, if you've seen that particular interplay before and like what the outcomes were.
It wasn't exactly the same. As I understand it, the incidents during the Kennedy and Johnson administration were trying to use the Fairness Doctrine, which generally speaking was supposed to be kind of an even-handed, balanced requirement providing balance presentation of things as a mechanism for trying to suppress conservative criticisms of the administration's policies. Again, you could say, well, that's different because they're using the Fairness Doctrine in an improper way, whereas here they're using their other powers in an improper way. You know, everything is different. Analogies are only analogies.
Sure.
If they were exactly the same, they'd be identities. But it does strike me as part of a bigger picture of that when the government
I only bring that up, Eugene, because it gets to this broader idea of you've housed various authorities within one federal regulator. And some people just have a problem with that in general, concentrating too much power in one regulator, powers that maybe are not necessarily derived from the same place, but can be played off one another. I mean, I think that's some people's concern here.
Yeah, I don't think that's the problem here. I'm not a fan of concentrating power in various ways.
Yeah.
But imagine there was just not the FCC, but just a federal broadcasting mergers commission.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That Brendan Carr was the head of. And the only authority he had was to stop a merger.
Sure.
He could still
mm-hmm. use that authority.
Right.
And again, we're not sure if that's what he was doing here, but hypothetically, he could still use that authority, that only authority he had. He could still leverage it in order to say, essentially, if you guys don't shut down the show, then I'll stop your merger. Whether it's concentrated or not, so long as the government has this kind of power, there is this danger. So one possible tool is diminish government power. Say, you know, leave the mergers to the just
the private market,
normal market process. Another possibility, though, is to make sure that that if the government does make these threats, then that is legally actionable. The Supreme Court reaffirmed that in NRA v. Vullo, and that there is political pushback, which, again, I'm very happy to see Senator Cruz trying to provide.
Yeah. Let's read a couple comments before we go to break. By the way, Kathy on Facebook says this is censorship. Lobster on YouTube says Disney is in the wrong and Disney's decision will hurt us all. Victor on Facebook says, I really dislike Jimmy Kimmel, but it's chilling that the FCC head would say that and have that lead to what has happened. Those are all comments we're getting online, and we want to hear from you. What do you think about the Disney ABC suspending Jimmy Kimmel and the FCC pressure? Give us an email, studio2@whyy.org. Whole lot more coming up after the break. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. This hour, we're talking about the FCC and free speech in the wake of Jimmy Kimmel's suspension. With us are David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent, and Eugene Volokh, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and professor of law emeritus at UCLA.
And we want to hear from you, our listeners. The recent debate about the power of the FCC was caused by the firing of, or should say, the suspension of late night host Jimmy Kimmel. What did you think when you learned about his suspension? And what are your thoughts about the pressure from the FCC? The phone number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you could drop your comments in the chat. By the way, we're going to bring in another caller. We have Brian from Morristown on the line. Brian, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Thank you for having me. I just might want to say first that it's nice that we can openly have these debates. But my comment is that this is just another way that Trump, who has no regard for the Constitution, much less the First Amendment, is using the FCC to control the narrative. He's weaponizing it just like he's weaponizing the judicial system to control the narrative and basically get back at anyone he doesn't like, because his biggest fear is the unfiltered truth. Yeah. And that's the truth of any authoritarian dictator.
Thank you. That's Brian from Morristown on the line, giving his opinion. And so, David, we want to bring you back into the conversation because the president has made comments specifically referring to FCC powers and these licenses. I want to sort of talk about the whole idea of the public interest and what you've seen sort of people in having this debate about the FCC powers around the public interest. Have we seen anything like this previously?
Well, the idea of the public interest is pretty nebulous. It's sort of what a majority of the commissioners decided to be at the time, but it's a way to allow them to weigh in when something seems particularly egregious. You know, there's things like obscenity and profanity and things that are a little bit more specified, but also are a little bit vague around the edges. The thing that, given the lack of clarity on that, the thing that really is, I think, most important to focus on in some ways is that this is not unprecedented, as Gene has mentioned. I do think the way in which this is sort of a 360 approach by the Trump administration, it is an all-encompassing, it keeps changing and only expanding the ways in which there are levers of power and pressure being brought to bear. You have the president in his private capacity, but on the verge of taking office again, starting to sue major news organizations, as it happens, ABC and CBS. More recently, he's sued multi-billion dollars, right? He sued the Wall Street Journal, owned by his political ally, Rupert Murdoch, for $10 billion. He sued the New York Times for $15 billion. That Brendan Carr has not only talked about, well, you know, I might take action. He has instituted formal investigations of stations and networks, every single major broadcast presence, including NPR and PBS and its stations, and ABC, CBS, NBC, everything except Fox, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch himself. These are not incidental. Mm-hmm. These are not accidental. In his first term, Trump, was very clear that he wanted the sale of Time Warner Media, the parent company at that time of CNN, which he was, you know, denouncing as fake news pretty much every hour on the hour. He wanted that proposed sale to AT&T tied up, in part because he was upset with CNN, in part because Rupert Murdoch had basically asked him to, because he had his eye on Time Warner as well. Yeah. Now, they failed, but they did a full court press on essentially a legal proposition that hadn't been used in almost four decades to try to tie it up. Meanwhile, you know, in 2017, 2018, when Rupert Murdoch wanted to sell most of his Hollywood holdings to Disney, which was a clear consolidation sort of antitrust concern, Trump asked him by phone, are you going to hold on to Fox News, which, of course, has been so important to Trump? Murdoch says yes. And then he said, well, good luck with you. That sounds great. You know, they did the Matador defense and waved it through. So the exercise of power is not simply limited to this. This is an incredibly blatant example of the pressures and levers of government being brought to bear at this time on media actors, whether or not you like the individual things that have been said.
Let me read this comment, though, from Paula on Facebook, who says, WHYY, it's just as bad as ABC and Disney. WHYY is still crying because they had their federal funding cut off.
And ABC News doesn't want to admit corporations don't want to spend advertising dollars on a show that doesn't have any viewers. Now, I read that comment, Eugene, because I'm trying to get a sense of what animates Trump and some of his allies on this issue. And I do think I understand on some level the frustration of like turning on a late night show, whether it is Kimmel or Colbert, and you could throw Fallon or Seth Meyers in there, and seeing a point of view that you feel like just doesn't represent you, that is slanted the other way, and that they're looking for some lever to pull to balance the scales again. Again, that's not really about the legal argument here. That's about this sense of aggrievement and unfairness that I think does animate some of what we're seeing. And I'm curious if you can give us any insight into that as someone, you know, who travels in right-leaning circles and can maybe just like explain for us what you think perhaps the goal is from the right-leaning perspective here, Eugene.
Sure. So I think the answer, the problem is human nature.
Yeah.
It is human nature to want to suppress other people's speech because human nature to speak, and speaking is tremendously important to humans. That's why we're kind of at the top of the food chain, not because we're bigger, stronger, or have sharper claws than the animals. It's because we can communicate. So it's central to being human, and people get very upset at speech that they dislike, people on the left and people on the right. And on the left and the right, we see, I think, considerable groups of people who, despite that aspect of human nature, conclude that in a democracy, it's particularly important to protect a wide range of speech. Traditional liberals on the left, libertarians and many conservatives on the right. Then we see people who don't take that view or ostensibly take that view, but still, human nature being what it is, lash out. That is complicated by various other factors, one of which I call censorship envy. When you see people on the other side getting to suppress speech that they dislike, you sort of feel like, why can't I get some of that? I think we were seeing that in particular with regard to calls to get people fired, the FCC-based calls, but calls to get people fired by their employers, whether government employers or private employers, for their statements about Charlie Kirk, some of the statements really quite egregious, essentially defending the assassination. I think many conservatives say, well, wait a minute, you know, we saw how often people get fired for ostensibly racist speech or even really racist speech, but kind of extreme speech that is seen as right wing. Well, why can't we get people fired for offensive speech that we see as left wing?
Yep.
I don't think it's a good feature of human nature, mm-hmm. I should stress.
Yep.
But it is the way that humans operate, and it's quite regrettable to see that. I should say it isn't just a sense of, well, these shows are on the left. That is one of the concerns, but also the concern is they're on the left, and then they express such contempt for people on the right. They say they think they can get away with things that are false about people on the right. That is what I think makes people especially upset.
Yeah, understand.
That's not justification, yeah. But I do think that helps explain.
No, it's a good explanation. Thank
that
you.
That is. And let's bring a couple callers. Maybe we can get two in back to back. We have Karen from Cherry Hill on the line. Karen, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is, hi, thank you for taking my call. My comment is, I understand outrage. People are outraged, Jimmy Kimmel, yada, yada, but there was no outrage when Roseanne Barr got canceled, no outrage when the woman from The Mandalorian got canceled. They both texted things. They worked for Disney. Dave Chappelle got canceled for things he said.
Yeah.
Bill Maher got canceled. No outrage there. Again, they were not Dave Chappelle, but a lot of right-wing people, a lot of leaning to the right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Getting canceled and no outrage.
Yeah. Karen, can I just ask you real quick, just to follow up because we got you on the line. Mm-hmm. I think what some people object to here, not
government,
all,
yeah.
is the government's mm-hmm. interference in
yes,
this case.
I get it. I do understand that.
Yeah.
But initially, before the government got thrown in, there was outrage immediately that night and the next morning. He said something, First Amendment. But when you work for a large company, mm-hmm. you sign a contract and they have every right. I've always worked for large companies and they have that right. But immediately,
yeah.
First Amendment, the gut reaction, the knee-jerk reaction was, oh, no, it's Trump, it's large government. But I think it's just Trump haters, and I
you
don't
think it's imbalanced.
That,
do you think
the imbalance and what your person just said before? There's just so much hatred.
And Karen, quick follow up.
Yes.
Do you think?
Sorry.
Do you think that ABC Disney would have acted had? Would they have fired Kimmel or suspended Kimmel had you not heard the comments from the commissioner, had you not heard the comments from the president?
I hope not, but it seems to be previous years, people were suspended when Trump wasn't in office.
Yeah.
By Iger.
Thank
when
you.
When he was Disney president the first time and then, you know, left and came back.
It's true.
He
yep.
seems
yep.
to be that guy.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's the Bob Iger of this all. Yeah. Thanks so much, Karen. I want to get one more caller here. We are coming toward the end. And this is just a straight question, I think, from Joan in Exton, a legal question. So Joan's on line five. Joan, real quick, what's your question for us?
Yeah, given that it's unlikely that ABC or Disney are going to pursue this any legal action on this, given how they've reacted, if Jimmy Kimmel himself were to want to take legal action and sue for his First Amendment rights, is one, do you think that the Supreme Court would allow him standing and say that, you know, his personal free speech was impeded and therefore he has a right to sue?
Yeah.
Or would they not even listen to the merits and dismiss it on a procedural matter and say he doesn't have standing?
Yeah. Real quick, Gene, what are your thoughts on this hypothetical Jimmy Kimmel or even if ABC had decided to pursue this?
Right. So in principle, Jimmy Kimmel might have a lawsuit against the government if he can show that he was indeed suspended because of this government pressure. I think the caller's reference to standing, perhaps as a reference to another case the court decided last year, Murthy v. Missouri, where people were challenging the Biden's administration alleged pressure against pressure on social media platforms that was aimed at trying to get certain people kicked off of the platforms or certain posts kicked off of the platforms. And there the court said there wasn't enough to show standing to allow the case to procedurally go forward. It's hard to know. That area is a very complicated area of the law. As I said, for business reasons, I can't imagine Kimmel would want to sue, even if he had solid evidence.
Yeah.
He sues the government in a way that may reflect badly on his employer, or even if he leaves his ex-employer. That's just not good in Hollywood.
That is the issue there, because we don't have the lawsuit and we have new media organizations.
And everyone's disincentivized from bringing the lawsuit.
And so
right?
what does that mean? Yeah. And to me, does that raise concerns? What legal concerns does that raise when you don't have organizations like ABC or Disney standing up and asserting their rights, when you don't have a Jimmy Kimmel willing to, for business reasons, to assert his rights? What does that mean for the First Amendment and the line that has been drawn between censorship and an actual government regulation?
Well, as a general matter, in very, very many areas of free speech law, most people don't sue. Most people don't raise First Amendment problems. You could be, say, you're being prosecuted for your speech. A lot of people will plea bargain because they don't want to face the risk. They don't want to face the expense if they are paying for their own lawyer and the like. So fortunately, precedents can be set by just a few people who are willing to challenge it. So we're seeing, for example, with the Trump administration's pressure on law firms. Many law firms went along with it, but several fought it, and they got favorable district court decisions. Now, only a tiny fraction of all cases end up before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Sure.
But sometimes good precedents can be set even in lower courts. So I totally appreciate that there are major limits on how one can challenge it in court. That's one reason why political pushback is, I think, so important.
Yeah. Just a minute left real quick, David. I want to make sure you get one more word in. I think you know the media sphere very well. You know how the folks that run these companies think, what incentives they respond to. And I'm just curious what you think might push them over the edge toward taking a stand. Like, how could, I really think it would have to be messing with their money in such a way that they would finally say, all right, we are going to take you on, whether it's in the court of public opinion or the court of law. Just take us inside their world real quick and how they might think about this, David.
Well, right now, I think you're seeing an incredible split between those companies that have a major amount of business being regulated by the federal government, and that includes newspaper owners like Jeff Bezos in Washington and Patrick Soon-Shiong in Los Angeles, and the broadcasters and cable companies, all highly regulated in a variety of ways, and those that aren't. You're seeing the New York Times stand up and say, we're going to fight this. We're going to fight this lawsuit, and we're not going to do it. Rupert Murdoch, who's highly regulated the broadcast side, nonetheless, for the Wall Street Journal, for the moment anyway, we'll see. He settles a lot of things. But this one, they say, we're going to defend this. Even NPR, I don't speak for the network or for my parent company, but and NPR has lost its federal funding. And that, too, was part of, I think, this overall case I'm making about Trump's effort against the press to silence or smother voices that it's reporting things not convenient. You know, even NPR has fought them in court. But the last point is the First Amendment isn't about whether things are tidy or always perfectly fair or what you want to hear. The principle of the First Amendment covers a lot of speech that you may not enjoy.
Yep. Yeah. Well, we enjoyed this hour with both of you and our callers. Let me thank you, David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent, and Eugene Volokh, professor emeritus at UCLA Law School and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. Thank you both this hour.
Thank you.
You bet.
And thank you to everybody who called in. Kathleen from Brooklyn, New York. Sorry we could not get to you. Thanks to everybody who commented on YouTube and in the email. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you tomorrow.